Sunstone presents this live recording from the 1987 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 26th through the 29th. We take you to the Marriott Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
The last session of the program, indeed the very last session listed in the little booklet, except for our banquet this evening. Identification in the program to the contrary. I am not Stanford J. Ricks, but Reed Hunter, pinch hitting for Mr. Ricks, who was unable to make it. I have asked our two participants if they have any additional information they would like conveyed to you, other than the short summaries listed in the program. Our presenter, Andrew Ehot, says he is comfortable with being identified as the co-editor of the Words of Joseph Smith. Our commentator, Jesse Embry, who is the director of the Oral History Program at BYU, wanted me to add that her book, Mormon Polygamous Families, Life and the Principle, will be published in October by the University of Utah Press, which seems to me to be something to be looked forward to. We are a couple of minutes late getting started, and we will save whatever time is left after the presentations for questions if our presenters are willing to entertain them. With that introduction, let's move right into the body of the program. Mr. Ehot, please.
Some of you, in seeing the program as it is, I noticed that you have a truncated title. I'll give you the full title: England's Poet Laureate and the American Prophet, the Larger Historical Implications of the Plural Marriage Parallels Between John Milton and Joseph Smith. I'd like to say at the outset before I would like to, if there's any worthiness in this presentation, that it might be remembered in the name of Stephen F. Christensen, who started the Deseret Research Foundation on my behalf. The foundation funded much of the research that I associate with this paper. At the same time, Joseph Smith was granted his first glimpse of the gold plates in the fall of 1823. Across the Atlantic, another long-lost work was rediscovered. Symbolically, both records have folded together many times since. Missionaries of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints have at times been greeted as they visited homes in the British Isles with, "Oh, you're from the church John Milton started." Most frequently, the young, perplexed missionaries probably thought to themselves, "Who is John Milton, and what does he have to do with the founding of the church?" The reason for the confusion between the American prophet and England's poet laureate is the convolution of their coincidentally uncovered records. As Leo Miller has succinctly summarized the Milton side of the picture, that John Milton was a great poet, some people have heard. A few people also know that he wrote some political pamphlets in prose, favoring Republican government against monarchy, advocating separation of church from state, and defending freedom of the press from pre-censoring licensors. Only a very few specialists know that he also wrote on theology. So very few indeed know that in his treatise on Christian doctrine, he devoted considerable effort to argument in favor of the lawfulness of polygamy. But why did Milton choose to produce an extended and defensive exegesis of all the polygyny-related passages of the Bible as part of this scriptural commentary that serves as a window on the theological foundation of his greatest work, Paradise Lost? His personal and autobiographical papers provide no clues. He had, during his vast sweep of the classical secular sources, occasionally taken notes on favorable instances of polygyny, but when polygyny occurs in any of his writings published during his lifetime, it appears very obliquely. So much so that though the important early biographers, whose interviews and gathering of tidbits spurred later scholars' speculations that Milton was more than just theoretically interested in polygyny, yet until the discovery of De Doctrina Christiani, Milton's biographers never suspected this radical side of the Puritan prophet. As Charles R. Sumner states in his preface to his 1825 translation of Milton's theological treatise, on the subject of divorce, the line of argument pursued in this treatise coincides with the well-known opinions which Milton has elsewhere so zealously advocated. To his heterodoxy on this point must now be added what hitherto has been unsuspected, his belief in the lawfulness of polygamy, to which he appears to have been led by the difficulty he found in reconciling the commonly received opinion with the practice of the patriarchs. Milton did not seem bred to develop such notions. He was born in December of 1608 on the eve of the first settling of British colonists in America. His grandfather was a staunch Roman Catholic who disinherited Milton's father when John Milton Sr. turned Protestant. John Sr.'s comfortable but hard-earned fortune made it possible for the young Milton to receive a classical education. He had a temperament for the challenge. He was a voracious reader. Milton attributed his later total blindness to the fact that from 12 years of age on, he rarely quit his reading before midnight. At age 16, he commenced studies at Christ College, Cambridge. Before completing the bachelor's degree in 1629, he had already composed worthy poetry in Latin, Italian, and English. In July 1632, at age 23, he received his Master's of Art degree. He did not marry for another 10 years. Instead, he devoted his time to study and writing, living at his father's homes, first at Hammersmith and later at the country estate at Horton. A year after the death of his mother, he set off for a year in Italy, and in the summer of 1639, he returned to England to teach and to become immersed in the English Revolution. But this Renaissance humanist and Platonist was also a Christian, so he celebrated classical study, always, however, with due deference to Bible and Christian teachings. So on the brink of the Civil War and with Puritan zeal, he commenced a pamphleteering career which gave him his first wide public attention when he bashed the Presbyterians, the Catholics, and the Anglicans. But none of this seemed a prerequisite for unorthodoxy. However, when a month or so after his marriage to Mary Powell, she returned to her family ostensibly on a visit which extended 3 years, Milton's mind turned in earnest to the questions of divorce. Mary, an uneducated daughter of a royalist family, was only half Milton's age. Perhaps she found his discipline and now inbred sense of bachelor independence unabated. Well, on the other hand, the separation may have been unnecessarily lengthened when the Civil War broke out a couple of months later. Reconciliation was not the spirit of the age. It was difficult for them both because travel at best was treacherous, but more importantly, Milton's anti-royalist sympathies did not set well with his wife's family. During the period of his separation, he published 5 times on the theme of divorce. Milton argued that a more valid justification for divorce was incompatibility, rather than the only reason sanctioned by the church, adultery. To be compelled to be changed to a loveless companion went against reason. But Milton had to muster better arguments than humanism to support his case, and some fascinating exegesis, which we will review later, formed the basis of his scriptural and social argument for the liberalization of the divorce code and even the secularization of the handling of divorce proceedings, proceedings which to this time still remain in the hands of the church. His end objective was too advanced, however. Although there were some similar Christian voices on the continent, about the only thing he accomplished was to attract abuse throughout the kingdom from Presbyterians and Royalists alike. Without knowledge of his polygynous sympathies, his detractors attacked him the same as they did others who wanted to change the divorce code. They hurled at him the invective pejorative, "You polygamist!" But not until 150 years after the death of Milton did the manuscript evidence come forth that he was a theoretical polygynist. He did not write this piece on biblical polygyny until at least a decade after the separation, probably not until at least 3 years after Mary Powell died due to the complications accompanying the birth of their daughter Deborah. Yet with Doctrina, before the scholars, Milton's camaraderie with several women during the separation period, in particular his attachment to a Miss Davis, has created the unsubstantiated speculation that if Milton could not publicly revise the code for divorce, he privately approached Miss Davis with the proposal of polygyny. Regardless of speculation, finally, in 1645, friends intervened. Visiting with them, all of a sudden, Milton, unbeknowing of their assistance, was motioned to enter the adjacent room. There he found Mary, with tears coursing down her cheeks, bowed before him, begging forgiveness. Thus ended any chance of simultaneous polygyny. Only for the scholar's eyes did Milton compose his theological treatise, into which he poured his scriptural arguments for his concept of marriage, polygyny, and divorce. Written in Latin, entitled as a posthumous work of Christian doctrine, by and large, is a relatively tame tome. Here and there in the work, the scholars have found evidence of Arianism, Antinomianism, Quakerism, Ranter thinking, and other assorted radical views of the day. His ideas were not entirely original, any more than anyone else's. But his boldness for polygyny and divorce, a decade after his failures as a divorce propagandist, were still 200 years ahead of his time. Silence did not mean he had abandoned his former arguments. His 10th treatise of the overall 50 pieces comprising Christian doctrine was his intended last form for which he would distill his thoughts on marriage and divorce. Unlike other compositions, this time, however, he gave explicit emphasis and concentration to a scriptural defense of biblical polygyny. Yet throughout this defense, not one explicit reference is made to secular sources. The analysis is entirely scriptural. Any passage which superficially seems to discount polygyny, Milton adroitly gives a proper interpretation. It is little wonder, then, that two centuries later, when Mormon missionaries faced the challenge of explaining the Church's recent public announcement of plural marriage as a tenet of the faith, that Milton's discourse on the subject, then having been known only for 20 years, seemed a timely discovery. An extract from Milton's polygyny piece first appeared in the Millennial Star, that is, in church literature, LDS literature, the Church's official magazine published in England. Later, the same article was reprinted in Utah. Omitted from this Mormon printing of Milton's treatise on marriage is his social analysis on the scriptural texts he quoted. It is in this section of the treatise where Milton presents his precise on divorce, which equally parallels Joseph Smith's thinking on that subject as well. Why focus on this part of the John Milton-Joseph Smith polygyny parallels? Well, I'd like to explore the idea that it should not be startling that there were these parallels of thinking between John Milton and Joseph Smith on marriage. I would like to do this by reanalyzing a controversial incident in the early history of Mormon plural marriage, an incident which can now be seen from a larger historical perspective because of the John Milton-Joseph Smith parallels. The incident which bears this out and to which I refer is the theory that Joseph Smith, in an attempt to assess the feelings of Nauvoo regarding plural marriage, at least condoned and perhaps helped write a work penned by a non-Mormon named Udenihay Jacob. The essay was published under the title The Peacemaker, a piece which was issued by the Mormon Press in late 1842, having the reference J. Smith, printer, on the cover. Lawrence Foster and Richard Van Wagener, authors of the two most recent and highly acclaimed works on the subject of Mormon plural marriage, have both concluded that while it is doubtful that Joseph Smith was the author of The Peacemaker, it may have been commissioned by him, but in all probability was put forward, quote, as John D. Lee later alleged, as a feeler to test church opinion, but was denied when public reaction proved too unfavorable, unquote. Both authors indicate that The Peacemaker presents a unique as well as an unusual argument. Foster summarizes the essential argument of The Peacemaker as follows. The complex and sometimes convoluted social argument of The Peacemaker may be summarized in three primary assertions. First, patriarchal authority and related patterns of male-female roles in the home and in society must be restored if social chaos is to be avoided. Second, a true or biblical standard of divorce must be reinstituted. It would allow women whose affections had become irrevocably alienated, and alienated is the key word that Jacob uses, alienated from their husbands to be divorced by them. Thus, the atmosphere of the home would not become poisoned because women were held in wedlock against their will. Finally, polygamy, the biblical form of marriage, must be instituted. If you did not know better, this accurately summarizes the three main points of Milton's treatise contained in Christian doctrine. Particularly note Milton's re-echoing of his pamphlet teachings on divorce, his teachings of 10 years before. The perpetual interruption of peace and affection by mutual differences and unkindness must be a sufficient reason for granting the liberty of divorce. And that it is such, Christ himself declares in the above passage. For it is certain and has been proved already that fornication signifies not so much adultery as the constant enmity, faithlessness, and disobedience of the wife, arising from the manifest and palpable alienation of the mind rather than of the body. Not to mention that the common, though false, interpretation by which adultery is made the sole ground of divorce, so far from vindicating the law, does in effect abrogate it. For it was ordained by the law of Moses, not that an adulteress should be put away, but that she should be brought to judgment and punished by death. It is important to note at this point that while neither Foster nor Van Wagner ever present direct evidence that Joseph Smith taught the formula, quote, alienation equals fornication, the stenographic report of the 8 October 1861 address by President Brigham Young, an address to which both Foster and Van Wagner only had sketchy accounts to make reference to, the link is explicitly made by Brigham Young. This confirms the similarity of thought between Joseph Smith, Udny Jacob, and John Milton on this point. Nevertheless, certain points suggest that Joseph Smith was more parallel in his thinking with John Milton than he ever was with Udny Jacob. Milton, for example, is far less oppressive of women than Jacob comes off as being. In fact, it can be demonstrated that Jacob's significantly demeaning view of women was something he did not share in common with Joseph Smith either. But another set of nitpicky details ought to be pointed out. While Foster and Van Wagner both quibble with Joseph Smith's denial of involvement with Jacob in the publication of The Peacemaker, they both fail to note that during the time the article was typeset and prepared for publication, Joseph Smith was in hiding, having been away from the printing establishment for at least 2 months. Apostle Wilford Woodruff, the principal assistant in the office, was also absent for a period of 6 weeks. And as pointed out in his recently discovered journal, Apostle John Taylor, the chief administrator of the printing office, later indicated that Joseph Smith wanted him to conduct a thorough campaign to put down the notion that the prophet had had any association with the Jacob production. Joseph Smith genuinely believed the Peacemaker tract, according to John Taylor, was a corrupt work. This still does not deny that Joseph Smith benefited by the production of the piece, inasmuch as he had another chance to gauge the reaction Nauvoo would have to the introduction of polygyny. But Joseph Smith did not need any other feelers to guess what the consensus of Nauvoo was. In fact, let us conclude this microscopic look at the theory principally espoused by John D. Lee, his unequivocal assertion that Joseph later denied involvement only to quiet rumors tying him to the piece, when we realize that Lee did not receive his indoctrination into plural marriage until a year and a half later, after the pamphlet's publication, it seems highly probable that he did not see from first hand the production of the piece. Thus, when Lee reported the connection between what he had heard of Joseph's teachings regarding alienation and the Jacob pamphlet, it seems more likely that he was indulging in the same kind of speculation which others engaged in when they linked Joseph Smith and the Peacemaker simply on the basis of coincidence of ideas, overlooking the deeply disturbing differences with regard to these men's variant views on women. Joseph Smith's and Udny Hay Jacob's ideas coincided on certain points is not as compelling evidence of collusion when seen from the larger perspective suggested by the parallels between Joseph Smith and John Milton, and for that matter, a host of other pro-polygynous Christians who over several centuries addressed similar issues in similar ways. I will have to confess here at the outset of the conclusion that the John Milton-Joseph Smith parallels were only one among other examples which could have been chosen to illustrate this call for greater Catholicism in our studies of the subject which is our greatest controversy. As we have been so often reminded this year, this is the sesquicentennial of the emergence of Mormonism in the British Isles. I therefore thought it only fitting to choose this previously unobserved tete-a-tete between John Milton and Joseph Smith's thinking as a way of symbolizing the need we have to celebrate the anniversary of the transcendence of Mormonism across continental barriers by resolving to broaden our historical perspectives accordingly. I infer from these hitherto far larger historical implications for the writing of LDS history in general, polygyny in particular. Even in the several recent and highly acclaimed works on the subject, a striking deficiency continues in the area of Mormon plural marriage studies. The defect I see is that very little has been done to explain the Mormon marriage system within its obvious but still largely ignored Western and Christian intellectual history context. Indeed, the studies published so far, when viewed from this broader context, still are relatively narrow in historical perspective. But there is hope. For example, even though Foster chose to limit the scope of his comparative analysis to the three most important radical marriage systems of antebellum American history, he nevertheless significantly enhanced the value of his study by incorporating insights from anthropological studies of groups which undergo major social transformations. His interdisciplinary approach is a model by which the yet unwritten definitive study of Mormon polygyny must build. And while Davis Bitten failed to explicitly point out the need for a more general study, his applause for one scholar's attempt to place Mormon polygyny as a successor to Christian polygyny, experimented with by several sects since the Protestant Reformation, is a hint that such a study is long overdue. Axiomatic of such a study would be to place Mormon marriage within the perspective of the lengthy gestation period before monogamy became the preferred marriage ideal of the West. Additionally, the Roman Church's similarly lengthy absorption from several sources of the ideal of virginity, that the priesthood could only be possessed by celibates, not by the chaste, calls to mind the importance of characterizing the Protestant Reformation as a transcendent precursor of Joseph Smith's ultimate revelations that the highest powers of the priesthood could not be controlled in this life or in the world to come without the trials, temptations, and commitments associated with worthy marriage. Such a study would sense that cultures that sanction polygyny often give it the social status of the ideal. Social arguments for this ideal are remarkably similar to the social arguments that emerge from the internal defenders of Mormon plural marriage. Such cultures believe that liberty and equality were not suppressed, but were enhanced by polygyny. With nearly every scholar of Mormon polygyny, the presentation of the facts never transcends the social and intellectual values of modern Western tradition. Our current concept of the structure of the family, the imperative romance before marriage, or the equation romance implies monogamy, only expose a modern Western bias. What seems never to be mentioned is the fact that such elements of Western society have only relatively recently become set in conscience. Within the last five centuries, because of the increase proselytizing by Christian missionaries in non-Western societies where polygyny is more often the rule than the exception, both Roman Catholicism and Protestantism have had voices within its loyal ranks who have advocated leniency toward polygynous converts by not requiring an imposition of immediate monogamy on those who had several wives before Christ came into their lives. But even these students are unwilling to take the ultimate logical steps to their analyses. From both a Christian as well as a Western intellectual history standpoint, the following context should seem obvious, but as yet it has not been the backdrop for studies of Mormon polygyny. The Western religious world has gone to considerable lengths to deny its polygynous history. More than a millennium and a half after the passing of the apostles, history, beguilingly called theology, finally finished the divorce proceedings of Christianity from polygyny. Or did it? Recent important studies are examining this case. The illusion for the majority of Christians in our little Western world has been successfully created that Christ, rather than in truth, the evolving church, had embraced as its only authorized marriage form the Roman code of monogamy. This whitewashing ignored that polygyny was practiced among the righteous both before and after its codification by the law of Moses. Even the fact that Jesus did not change the laws regarding polygyny has been ignored. Thus, while St. Augustine could not conceive of Christians in his day being pure enough to practice polygyny, he did not propose scriptural nor theological reasons for not advocating it, and so he did not ensue theological grounds rejected as lesser minds would centuries after him. And among the Jews, though there were only rare instances of its practice after the division of the Roman Empire, yet they still took at least an additional 500 years before they began a 7th century aloofness. And some question the use of the word ban there, so I use aloofness. A 7th century aloofness to the principle. Not only is it worthy of note that at least 2 Roman Catholic popes seriously entertained issuing dispensations granting individuals the privilege of practicing polygyny, but also no less a person than the founder of the Reformation, Martin Luther, also justified instances of this practice briefly in his day for basically the same reason the Book of Mormon would give as the principal reason for this practice, to raise up seed unto the Lord. To be sure, neither Catholic nor Protestant leaders of the post-Roman Empire period ever intended to give extended license to this practice. Nevertheless, as their often ignored considerations attest, it still required more time for polygyny to become official heresy. This it had certainly become by the time of Joseph Smith's America. Joseph Smith was between two worlds and two sets of worlds. Not just between heaven and earth, but between the world views of the West and the East. His immersion into the foreign world of the East, as he conducted his intensive translation of the Bible during the first 2 years of his ministry, seems to me to have been a largely underestimated intellectual ferment that served as a harbinger of his supposedly radical marriage revelation. Think of his rigorous and thorough analysis of the words of the ancient prophets and apostles with which he was now a fellow laborer. Did not his projection back into all aspects of the lives of Abraham, Jacob, Moses, and Nathan necessarily alter his views from an Occidental to a more Oriental perspective, even with regard to marriage forms? Might he have been conditioned by such an intensive study and sense of identification to be less inclined to reject polygyny as an authentic and under certain conditions an essential marriage form? If we were to learn that nearly every argument used in favor of polygyny in Mormon history had previously been suggested not only by some of the finest minds in the world but also in the West, might this affect our objective interpretation of Joseph Smith's motivations? It is my belief that studies of Mormon polygyny have been too narrowly focused. By this I mean that they have neither been microscopic nor macroscopic enough to present Mormon polygyny in light not only of as yet untapped early contemporaneous Mormon sources, but also of equal importance in its world history context. On the microscopic level, there has never been a rigorous, systematically produced chronology of the beginnings of Mormon polygyny that identifies as best as possible all those who were first informed of Mormon polygyny, when they were first informed, when they entered the practice, by whom they were first authentically informed of Joseph Smith's practice, and an identification of the periods during which they may have speculated about his or others' involvement in the practice before they first knew of the practice. I have tried to be that precise in all of my analyses, and I believe they have produced valuable new insights into the complexities of the beginnings of early Mormon polygyny. I believe that such a rigorous analysis is an essential first step in the writing of a history of Mormon polygyny. But even more importantly, it is the need to eradicate the deficiency currently existing in the study of Mormon polygyny from a macroscopic point of view. If we combine a more rigorous microscopic analysis of the primary historical sources which recount the origins of Mormon polygyny with a larger Western and Earth history macroscopic analysis of the like that I've suggested earlier in this paper, where already conducted intellectual, anthropological, and social histories of polygyny in non-Mormon settings are used to illuminate our understandings of Mormon polygyny, then I believe we will develop a perspective of far greater scope than what this, to us, highly controversial subject has previously received. Until, for example, Mormon studies incorporate the analyses and thinking of such individuals as St. Augustine, Pope Leo II, Philip Melanchthon, Martin Bucer, Martin Luther, Cardinal Cajetan, John Milton, Johann Laser, Martin Medan, Emanuel Swedenborg, to name only a few, not only will we continue to find ourselves threatened by this subject, still likely to degenerate our discussions to the level of pretentious and unilluminating dogmatics, but also we will still be unconscious that wherever we find the sense that this must be a subject of never-dying controversy, it is only confirmation of how ignorant we have been of our Western acculturation, our own religious myopia, and our own intellectual and spiritual shallowness.
Although I did agree to comment on Andy Ehat's paper, it was not with a little bit out with a little bit of fear. First of all, I read the title. Milton, he wrote Paradise Lost. What else? I don't know. What was Paradise Lost? I vaguely remember something about a war in heaven, Lucifer, and maybe Adam and Eve, but that was all. Then I read the paper and realized my fears were ungrounded and my boning up on Milton were unnecessary. Andy calls for a larger type of study, which I fully agree with. And I have talked with Andy briefly about the subject. I can't really comment about his call for a better look at the early practice of polygamy in the Mormon Church, though I will make an attempt at the end. But I understand his call for examining it more carefully. I look at polygamy more from how it affected people rather than why the Mormons practice polygamy. And I find that in my studies of polygamy in the Utah in the late 19th century, that we all have a story about polygamy, and we all say, therefore, every family was like that. We take one story and we then make it into a generalization, and I think that's the same problem that Kimball Young had, and I think that's the same thing that Andy's looking at. Also, I really see a need to look at polygamy in a larger context. Until I started writing my book on polygamy, I really thought that the people in the Old Testament practiced polygamy and that it was never mentioned again until Joseph Smith received the revelation. I stumbled across a book called When Polygamy Was Made a Sin, which Andy tells me is not the most reliable source, but it's the source that I found. And I was surprised to know that Milton, Luther, and others had spoken about polygamy, that Martin Luther had even suggested that Henry VIII could have considered marrying another wife instead of considering divorce, that Catholic bishops in 1650, following the 30-year war, suggested that men marry additional wives and that priests marry in order to bring up a righteous, bring up a generation since so many people had been killed. As I was talking about that to a neighbor, a member of my ward in Provo, she mentioned that in doing her genealogy, she found a great-great-great-great-whatever grandfather who had married plural wives at that time period. You can imagine her shock as a convert to the church to find polygamous ancestors in her genealogy. So I think it's essential that we look at these in a larger context, and even I should have looked at it in a larger context. I checked my book and I have a page and a half in the whole book, but my context is mainly to look at relationships rather than at the history of polygamy. And so I think there is definitely a need for the larger study that Andy's calling for. I think that we need to look at polygamy in a larger context. It's ironic that we call for this larger study of Mormon polygamy, since that's really what we need to do in all of Mormon history. Too often we've looked at it too narrowly, and we haven't looked at it broadly. And we need to understand the social context of certain activities in Mormon history in general. Yet at the same time that I say that, that is what people like Lou Midgley and others who have called the new Mormon history have attacked us for, is because some historians have put it in the larger context. It seems that we get battered on every side no matter what we try to do. Andy's called for a larger study. Perhaps he looks like he should be the person to do it. Perhaps all of us who study Mormon polygamy need to look at it more broadly, and I think that is essential. I think there will always be problems, though, as we attempt to do that larger study. I think given the sources, particularly on early Mormon polygamy, that we have a hard time determining just exactly how much Joseph Smith did know of the peacemaker, and he's shown you some of the problems at understanding exactly what he knew. I reread the things that Foster and Van Wagner had said on the subject, and it really isn't very clear. I've listened to the debate that Andy and Richard Van Wagner have on polyandry, and I see them use almost exactly the same sources, and it's difficult sometimes because of the lack of sources to interpret it. I really think, though, that not only do we need to look at polygamy in terms of what Andy has mentioned, in terms of looking at the theoretical approaches that Milton and others took, but we also need to look at polygamy in a much broader sense, in how it has been practiced in other societies. In my research, I went through an atlas listing different societies, and I counted up that there were 84% of the 865 societies listed that practiced polygyny. 16% practiced monogamy, and 0.1% practiced polyandry. So we need to look at polygamy in a broader sense. I attempted to do that in my study because I wanted to see how families were set up in other societies. I think in my attempt to do that, and also in our attempt to look at the broader context of polygamy in terms of Milton or Luther or whoever, though, we may have a really hard time ever finding out what the common roots are and if there was anything that connects them together. In my case, I just found out that families were set up very much the same in Africa as they were in Mormon societies and Mormon polygamous families, but that probably is just the logical way that you end up having to set up families when you've got several wives and one husband. But what I learned from Andy's paper, which probably I did not learn from the book, isn't when polygamy was made a sin, is more on the background of Milton and how it might relate. And I think if we do that kind of broader study, if we also look at the anthropological studies, which Foster did some of, we can really get a better understanding of polygamy. I would like to add a word of caution in this matter, though, particularly when it comes to discussing why the Mormon Church practiced polygamy. I used to always wonder why the church was so defensive about polygamy. And then I was on a radio talk show with Royston Potter. I was asked very few questions, and I said very little. But after the show, Royston Potter took my hand in between both of his hands and said, "Thank you very much." I didn't know I'd helped him at all, and the last thing in the world I wanted to do was to help him. And now every time I see Royston Potter, I have this great fear. A friend keeps insisting that he really likes me, and that I better watch out, and he might be looking for a fourth wife. But as I think of Royston Potter, and I think of the underground, I hear about papers that probably Andy's written, that I know my friend Ken Can has written, ending up on the underground. I realize how carefully, when we talk about a defense of polygamy, we need to couch it in terms so it doesn't look like I'm not defending polygamy. I assume Andy's not defending the current practice of polygamy now, and we need to be careful of that. I think that, though, on the whole, Andy's appeal for a larger study is very important, and that as we understand how polygamy has been practiced in other societies, we'll be able to understand a controversial part of our history. Thank you.
We have some time for questions or comments. Please.
Andy, you mentioned the printing by the British Mission of Milton's treatise. Had that been published extensively or even limitedly before that?
It was rediscovered, as I indicated at the beginning of the paper,
in 1823.
In fall of 1823, and then discovered and published in 1825, translated into English, and I'm sure it was well known.
I can give a little bit. Amazingly enough,
in my study on Milton, I talked to Dave Whitaker, who has a chapter in his dissertation which is on pamphleteering about Luther and Milton. And a paper was presented at the Mormon History Association meeting by John Tanner, which Andy will be interested in finding out about how where the Mormons would have gotten the idea about Milton to use in the pamphlet. Tanner argues that the first mention of Milton was in a pamphlet published in India, but probably the ideas came from Orson Pratt, who probably would have read it, and that only for about a 2-year period were Milton's arguments used very extensively, and Tanner talks about some of the reasons why they weren't used for a longer period.
Yes.
I was just going to say that, I've seen both Tanner, and I dispute some of the things in Whitaker's thesis, how he's put together the chronology on Milton himself, particularly in his dissertation. I wasn't attempting to discern just how the Mormons had found out about Milton. It's just they did, and they published. And what I'm pointing out is that the fact that they printed only part of what he did would have has left Mormon historians on a lurch, because they apparently only read what was published in the Millennial Star and never went back to Milton himself. If they'd gone back to Milton himself and then seen the latter part of the dissertation and saw the parallels there on divorce, they wouldn't have said, like they have said, well, those are unique and unusual ideas that Jacob had, and wow, the Mormons had them in early the Utah territorial period, therefore Jacob influenced Mormonism, and that's it just doesn't follow. Post hoc ergo propter hoc fallacy. And I'm pointing out that here 200 years before, this notion of alienation and fornication, and when we talk about intellectual history, we have to realize that if you can't find it in a book, it still might be floating around the brains that go all the way through that period. And its rediscovery in 1823, and then maybe the transplantation of the idea of alienation, fornication, may not have been so radical as they suggest, even though to a 20th century historian who's looking back on it and sees Jacob's idea and then finds it in Mormonism but has never seen anything else referring to it, comes to the wrong conclusion.
I want to be clear, I understood what you meant on Jacob's idea, but you're saying he got those from Milton then, or?
No, he may not know either. And Milton, I say too, is his idea that original? Made this correlation between alienation and the definition of fornication, where Jesus gives his explanation for the real reason for divorce. And that notion may have been carried down. It seemed unorthodox in Puritan England during that period, but still other people took up the same tune later on.
I wrote a piece on that some years ago, and it seemed to me rather intriguing that Brigham Young seemed to believe that concept of alienation, and you get the hint that that was the basic idea of fornication.
The actual stenographic report of the discourse, which neither you nor Ben Wagoner or Foster had access to when you did your work in the 60s and they did theirs in the 80s, he explicitly identifies that these were teachings he obtained from Joseph Smith, and as the preface to his discourse, he indicated that he did not intend to have it published. So just like Milton, so Brigham Young wasn't going to publish the ideas. Fortunately, Beck's notes were found, so Foster and all, but they couldn't make the direct correlation to Joseph Smith like that document shows. And there's also minutes in the Wolford Woodruff Journal that indicate that Brigham again says that Joseph taught this idea of alienation of affections is the idea of fornication.
Right. Well, but then you made the point, though, that probably there are a lot of things in Jacob's article that Joseph probably didn't agree with.
Yeah.
What were some of those in contrast to that kind?
The main thing that I highlight is the contrast of feeling about about women and their nature.
They're sort of like property.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't necessarily say that, because that notion was a very common current notion in antebellum American society. It wasn't really eliminated till late in the century, I'm sure.
Even later than that.
but, you know, like Emma couldn't hold property, you know, and many of those notions persisted long after even Joseph Smith's death. Those are cultural elements of his, or elements of his culture. But just the feeling and denigration of women that more generally appears in the Jacob pamphlet, I don't think is something that that Joseph Smith appears to be feeling when you read the 30 March and 28 April discourses of Joseph to the Relief Society, and elements of the temple ceremony and conferral priesthood authority that comes to women through the higher ordinances of the temple. And that, you know, of course, Jacob apparently wrote this pamphlet, or, you know, sometime before that. At least by 1840, he had written to Martin Van Buren, President of the United States, offering to publish it. So here's 2 years prior to, to suggest collusion is kind of is different. Kenneth Godfrey had a piece published to indicate that, where he cited a letter of Jacob to Joseph Smith in early 1844, a year and a half after the publication of The Peacemaker, where Jacob indicates, "I've never even met you. You know, I mean, we haven't talked face to face ever." Of course, then those that really are diehards will say, "Well, there were intermediaries." You know, it's that kind of thing.
Is there any evidence that Joseph Smith got ever had any contact then with anything Milton had written at all?
I don't recall if the 1830 list of the library in Palmyra. I'm sure there's Milton there. And I, again, these.
You said that would be an interesting.
Yeah, well, I can't imagine. You see, there was a furor in England, and I'm sure it was transplanted here to America, regarding the discovery of Milton's plural marriage treatise. That may well have been in the back of everybody's mind. But then, of course, as most things, they just kind of slip away.
Please.
Wasn't there quite a distinction between the polygamy practiced by Joseph Smith and that practice during the Graham era? It's not one of my strong points, and I'm not really up on all the, you know, different wives just had and all the practices he had with them. But I, from what I've gathered, it seemed that Joseph, with the 40-some wives that he had, that he, there was no, in the break, during the Brigham Young era, it seemed like there was cohabitation, that they had the wives living in, you know, one house together in many instances, or the houses were close to each other, and they even built houses. Joseph Smith, it almost seemed to me like he was just kind of sleeping around, and yet he just, you know, gave it some scriptural license or spiritual license there.
Well, it's clear that during the two different periods, one was covert, the other overt, but Jesse could probably comment more accurately about the social side. Just the nature of the covert operation, as it were, of plural marriage during the prophet's lifetime necessarily entailed those things. But to those that had been informed of it, to that subset of Mormon culture that were aware of plural marriage, he was overt in that society, an inner society.
And polygamy was, even in Utah, was only practiced for such a short time without any opposition. That what I argue is that you can never come up with a typical type of cohabitation for any type of family.
I had intended to include in this paper, but it would have gone not necessary, but it would have gone so lengthy, to point out that the social arguments that the Mormons develop for plural marriage are very similar to those that are found in other cultures. I did want to bring out any examples of it, but I make that point in the paper. But when you, in a sense, as those arguments were developing, 1890 was aborted, and we kind of were on a lurch. How do we just didn't have a length of time to develop not an affinity, but how would I phrase it? And the length of time to have adjusted our society to an acceptance of that, like in pro-polygynous cultures that consider this an ideal, when in fact it never is a very largely engaged in practice.
Well, in Joseph's case, he really didn't have an, you know, at least a good worldly argument for polygamy that I can think of.
some of the arguments that may have developed later on as far as building up a society or possibly the deaths of some of the husbands or whatever, and I'm not familiar with them all, but it seems like as far as Joseph's only qualification was merely his own spiritual authority, and that it was some higher law and some new law introduced to the brethren.
Well, he had more significant reference. He had other social reasons that he expressed, like the idea of raising up a righteous family. That's the only scriptural reference.
Of Joseph's, playing with sons or daughters.
There's at least, there is evidence of three. And there is a daughter that we definitely know about, but there are a couple other children references made, but no, there was the covert period, and his life was cut short.
Right. If Joseph Smith had lived longer and he had not had that kind of harassment, who knows what might have happened. I think it's because Brigham Young practiced it that it's put on as Brigham Young's adoption of polygamy.
Question in the back.
I wonder if either of you could comment on the relationship between the church and the press during the time of practice of polygamy, and how it perhaps put us on the defense, and how that may or may not have affected our attitude towards the press today as a church. Has anybody looked into that? Is that something that anybody has researched?
There are pieces on press reaction, and
I guess what I'm asking is, defensive?
Well, of course, there is the piece. There is a nice book by Bitten and who else deals with not the cartoon image, and I can't remember just how detailed they are about that, or do they extrapolate to the point of arguing about our situation? I can't imagine. When you think about the opening of LeGrand Richards's oral history, I believe that's his, and they asked, what's the most important thing that's happened in the 20th century, about the church? And the answer he gave wasn't something about the blacks and the priesthood or other major developments we think about, temple building or have you. He said that we're no longer facing the onslaught regarding polygamy. That was his.
We're overcoming the stigma of
polygamy. Forgive the paraphrase. Yeah.
Any further questions or comments? If not, we thank our participants for their excellent presentation.